Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
That was just awesome seeing that. Though. Oh, crap. Sorry, did you go live?
Okay. There you go. It's going. Come on. Here we go. It's taking forever.
There we go. Live.
It's exciting, isn't it? Are you scared? Do you know what to do? Have you ever been live before?
No, it's my first time.
Oh, man.
Honest.
Well, you're in for a treat.
I got to remember that one.
All right. Let's do the intro, and then we will be right back. Let's get it on here. Oops, that's the wrong intro. Always count on me to screw everything up here. That's great.
That goes to show you about the brains of the operation.
Yeah, he has not. Now it just disappeared. Where did it go? Here it is. All right, welcome to Rat Salad Review. Today we have a special guest, a guest that we've been waiting to have on this show for a very long time, Mr. Albert Bouchard. Hello, Mr. Albert Bouchard.
Hello. Pleased to be here.
Are you sure about that?
I think so. Pretty sure.
Yeah. Thank you for coming on the show, Greg. We're all huge fans of you, but Greg, he's like the ultimate fan. You know, he's got the Blue Oyster Cult shirt on. I mean, look at him.
Yeah. I see. That's official.
Literally quoted as saying that they are your favorite band. Correct, Greg?
Yep. Love them. Especially those early years when Albert was in the band. Just such an amazing group of musicians together. And then, you know, with Sandy on top of it, guiding everything. The vocal harmonies, the in the pocket playing, it's just something super special.
Thank you. Yeah. Well, we definitely had a chemistry, you know. I mean, you see that with a lot of bands though, you know. Who was I talking to? Somebody was talking about when the Young Rascals got back together, and how each one of them had a version of the Rascals that would go out and play, and it never sounded, and then the four of them got together, and you know, they're not getting any younger. They're older than I am. So, you know, and Gene Cornish is not well. And the drummer, I can't remember his name now, but he passed away just last year. So,
oh, really?
So, but when they got together, it sounded just like they always sounded, just like, in 2012, we got together, the five of us, the original five from Blue Oyster Cult, and we played a show in Times Square. One show was like the 45th anniversary or something. And, you know, they played with the new guys, you know, and then we came out and played, you know, the original five. And it sounded just like we hadn't taken a day off. It was amazing. It just sounded exactly like it used to sound. And
did you do a lot of preparing? The other guys came in.
What's that?
Did you do a lot of preparing to do that show? Like, I mean, how much did you have to really go back and you know, learn a lot of the songs? Or
yeah, I did. They gave me a list of songs to learn, and I worked on them a little bit by myself. And then the day before the show, well, no, it was a week before the show. Yeah, it was a week before the show. Oh no, it was the day of the show. That's right, because
really?
They had to postpone it. It was because of the hurricane.
Oh, right. This was right around Sandy, right?
Yeah, and I had already, you know, they wanted me to come for sound check, and we were gonna, you know, have a long, you know, 3-hour sound check, and before the show, and so I had a gig that night, but it was an early gig, so I was gonna go do their sound check, then go to this other gig, playing with Steve Marshall at the Iridium, and then on the break from his set, I was going to go back across the street to BOC and play with them, and then come back and play with Steve Marshall. So, you know, the set, he wanted me to do two sets. So anyway, but but then the hurricane came and everything was canceled. So and they rescheduled it for a week later. And the thing was that Joe was on a cruise, so he couldn't make it. He was on the Lynyrd Skynyrd cruise with the Cult Brothers.
Oh wow.
So he couldn't have done it, but then when, you know, because they switched it a week later, he could do it. So, you know, so it was all the original, you know, the original five of us, you know, and somehow I knew it would be the last. Alan was not, he was not well, so and he'd gone through a lot, you know. He'd had cancer, and then he was having a heart issue, and he had COPD. So everything that he liked to do, he couldn't smoke, he couldn't drink. But that night, he smoked and he drank.
Yeah, that footage exists on YouTube, and I got to admit, it was so bittersweet. The fact that it was the last time the five of you guys played together. I think Alan Lanier has to go down as one of the best multifaceted sidemen to ever grace the stage. I mean, just some of those piano parts that he created. I mean, everyone in the band is multifaceted and multi-talented, but, you know, just like, when you hear that intro to a song like Joan Crawford, or, you know, when him and Buck during ME-262 would start playing, and then you'd come in there and it'd be like this ridiculous wall of sound, this orchestral guitar solo. I mean, so many great memories that you can watch on the internet, and just, I don't know, I've always had the greatest respect for Alan, because myself, I play, you know, keyboards and bass and guitar as well, so, you know, I'd be lying if I said if he wasn't an inspiration.
The great thing about Alan was he Blue Oyster Cult was the first band he was ever in. He never played in any band before. And right. So he played different from all of the rest of us. The rest of us, we were used to, you know, learning every Beach Boys song and every, you know, Muddy Waters song and every, you know, Beatles song, and, you know, every song, you know, every jazz standard that everybody, you know, that's what Joe and I did. We were in a band for, we played about 400 shows, you know, before I dropped out of college and decided to come to the city and start this thing, you know. So we'd played a lot, but Don played in a surf band in high school, and yeah, that was, and Eric was in a bunch of bands. He had a high school band, then he had several bands at college. So all, you know, the four of us were very used to figuring out what you're supposed to do and stay right in your lane, you know. And Alan just didn't know how to do that at all, and it was wonderful. He never played the right chords. He just played, you know, for instance, the intro to Astronomy. That whole thing is in the key of D.
Right.
And then all of a sudden goes right into E, and it's like, whoa, so dramatic. You know, he was just fooling around saying, hey, I was thinking about an intro for this. And I'm like, whoa, that never in a million years could I think of that. Mm. You know, it was like, yeah. Amazing. So yeah, but entire astronomy, he's playing all these different chords, you know, that are not the chords that are being played, but they fit right. For some reason, you know, it fits with the melody or it fits some kind of way. It was, yeah, he was amazing. He was amazing. He could always, you could count on him to do something different, you know, that you wouldn't expect.
Yeah. So. Now Greg is going to kill me, but I always know of Blue Oyster Cult, you know, obviously the Don't Fear the Reaper and all that. And then Metallica did the covers album and they did Astronomy, a cover of Astronomy. Mm-hmm. Did you like that cover?
I love that cover.
You do?
I think it's amazing. My only disappointment is that it's too respectful. You know, really? I really wanted to hear them really heavy it up, and they didn't do that. And so then, you know, because they didn't do a full Metallica treatment on it, they never they didn't play it live, you know. And I thought, you know, if they'd done like they did Whiskey in a Jar or Turn the Page, you know, and really metallicize it, you know.
Yeah.
You know, but it's okay, you know, I got paid the same money.
But, you know,
Five figures for several years just from that one song.
Can't go wrong. But I heard that. I'm like, oh, like, whose song is this? Because I didn't know it was a Blue Oyster Cult song. And then when I found out, I'm like, oh my God, I got to go find out more Blue Oyster Cult because that song was awesome. And then when I heard the original version, and like you said, with all the keyboards and stuff that he did in there and how different it is from the other part of the song, it's just, that's just an awesome, awesome song. And I love it. And thanks to Metallica, I finally got into, you know, more Blue Oyster Cult.
Well, I got to know them when they put out the Ride the Lightning record. And at the time I was not in the band. I was just trying to make a little money here and there, you know, so I got a gig writing for Modern Drummer magazine.
Oh, all right.
You know, I'd been teaching at a place called the Drummers Collective because, you know, I just needed, you know, I would get some gigs, you know, I get some oldies gigs, you know, being the musical director, you know, for Spencer Davis and things like that. But it wasn't enough money to live on. So I needed something more steady. So I got this job at Drummers Collective. And then from there, I got to know Rick Mattingly, the editor of Modern Drummer. And so I did a bunch of stuff with them. Yeah, it was really funny because I did this, we can skip ahead for a second. I'm a good digressor. So
that's fine.
Or progressor. But fast forward to, that was back in, when did that come out? Like in, Ride the Lightning was
84.
Yeah. So around that time period, Modern Drummer had a festival. They had this festival, the Modern Drummer Festival, for 10 years, and it would be all the most popular drummers in the area, you know. But I mean, you know, like Joe Morello or Will Calhoun or, you know, all these people that, you know, were, you know, Steve Jordan, Carter Buford, you know, all these people would be there. Mm-hmm. And so one day, I can't remember who told me, but he said Joe Franco and who's the guy with the Dixie Dregs?
Rod Morgenstein?
Rod Morgenstein need a ride to New Jersey to this thing. So I gave him a ride, the three of us, and it was great. It was really fun. And Rod Morgenstein was such a, you know, he was introducing me to everybody, you know, because I, you know, I'm a little shy and they didn't really know who I was, and everybody
struck me as a social butterfly.
Well, once I get going, it's okay. But
no, I meant Rod never struck me as a social butterfly. I always just thought he was a guy who just stood behind his drums.
Oh no, he really is. So last February, just a month ago, we had a tribute show, a memorial for Scott Kempner. Because, you know, I've been playing in the Dictators, and the reason why I'm playing with the Dictators is because of Scott. Because Scott called me up from California and said, hey, man, Ross and Andy want to get the Dictators back together and we want you to be the drummer. And I'm like, oh, cool. So, you know, I started talking, you know, and we talked about bed, and then Ross called me and said, yeah, you got to do it, Al. You know, so I said, oh, you know, I'm playing guitar mostly. He goes, no, you got to play drums, man. So I said, okay. This was in 2019.
Yeah. And we actually had the Ross the Boss. I forgot that he talked about that. You remember, Lou?
I remember that. And yeah. I remember the single that came out, New York City. I think it was a song. And that was a good one. I really enjoyed it.
Yeah.
There is one song I would love to hear you guys do, especially with you on drums. Granted, it's not a Dictators original, but love Mata Hoople and the Dictators proto-punk feel. And they covered The Moon Upstairs on the live album in 81.
Yeah.
And I would love to hear your approach to that tune.
Yeah, well, you just might. We've recorded two shows so far, live shows.
Ooh.
We did 12 shows in Spain, and this was right towards the end of it. In Murcia, we did a live thing, multi-tracks. We have all of that, and then when we came back, we played a show at my father's place, and that was the weirdest thing, because I went in there and, you know, there's this, the sound guy is like, he's all crusty, you know, he's older than me. And he's like just complaining about everybody and everything. And he's lugging these big speakers in, you know, a little guy too, like me, I could just imagine myself doing this. And his wife is helping him, you know, and she's old and she's, you know,
jeez.
And they set all the stuff up on the stage. And it looks like it's not going to work at all. And it's a supper club. So it's all tables, which, you know, and like nice, you know, flowers and candles, you know, romantic.
That's awesome.
A little weird.
My father's place.
I said, oh, my God, this is going to be horrible. So our sound guy comes in and he says, where's the console? And the guy gives him iPad.
Oh, jeez.
So he has to mix it on iPad. And I said, oh, my God. And they're recording this. And it turned out that it was really simple. You know, the other guy came with his gear, hooked it up to the little distribution center or whatever it was, and so we got two live records. And I think that my father's place, well, that was a great show. We had Mark the Animal Mendoza just sit in with us. Yeah, what a player, man. Yeah, so it was great. It was a great show. And we did Moon Upstairs too, both of those
That's
shows.
Awesome.
So we have I haven't heard it, but you know, I didn't like the way they did it on the record, to be honest. I thought it was just the drummer, whoever it was, you know, I don't want to, I'm never disparage another drummer, but I felt like this person wasn't up to what it needed to be.
I agree. And you have a very Gene Krupa approach.
Yeah. Gene Krupa, you know, crossed with Keith Moon.
Yep. And
frightening thought.
I always thought that would be, you know, interesting to hear kind of Buffin's original lines applied that way. So
yeah.
Excited to hear that. Because no, they didn't do the best job of it.
yeah. No, they just love the song and they wanted to do it. And, you know, we started doing it. And Keith Roth loves the song too. So he wanted to sing it. And so we started doing it. And I'm like, we played it first. I think we did a tour of Canada and we played it up there. And I was just like, they wanted me to play it like whoever the drummer was that played it, you know, with him before. And I'm like, I'm not feeling this guy. So we came back and we redid the arrangement for the drum wise. So, you know, I think we might've changed the tempo a little bit. We took some bars out because it seemed like it was a little too repetitious and just made it a little more.
That driving. Is one thing about the Island years, as much as I love them though, you know, Guy would let them go on and on live in the studio and they're great songs, they're great performances, but Some of them can get to be a little too much when they start reaching the 8-9 minute mark.
Yeah, well, it was still long, but you know, there was a but the way that song had a lot of like pauses in it.
Yeah,
and I felt like it was too much, too many pauses, you know, especially going over and over for a long period of time. So, and Ross had a dynamite lead that he was playing in it, so he played basically the same thing he's been playing in that. So yeah, it's about the same length, but I took out some of the, you know, the pauses, made it more flow better.
So
flow better.
So we're happy to say that the third volume in the Reimagino saga is out and available. If you want to support Albert directly and not have him rely on lack of Spotify listens, go to his Bandcamp, albertbouchard.bandcamp.com. Support this man directly. Okay. So I just wanted to get that out of the way.
Oh, do I have a Bandcamp?
Yes. Because I follow you on it.
Oh, my God. Okay. That's cool.
But congratulations on the release of the third volume.
Thank you.
I, as an old school BOC fan, and just to give you a brief history, first album, I had two older brothers, and my eldest brother, Tony, had the cassette of Some Enchanted Evening, and that's what made me a fan, because that's when I first heard Godzilla. And after that, you know, as a young impressionable lad, I was hooked instantly. But that's the only album that I knew of up until middle school, when my my seventh grade social studies teacher lent me On Your Feet or On Your Knees, and I said, "Whoa, this album is better than Some Enchanted Evening," and you know, just instantly hooked and been a fan ever since. One question, and there's, trust me, we'll be asking you questions throughout the evening, but one question that I wanted to ask you regarding Reimaginos. So this is the third volume. Mm-hmm. There was the original attempt back in the late 80s, mm-hmm. which was supposed to be a solo album for you, mm-hmm. but the record label, Columbia, ended up deciding that they wanted to make it a BOC album. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, the old adage, too many cooks in the kitchen spoil the pot. Mm-hmm. I love what you've done with the Imagino story with these three albums, and I really appreciate the effort that you've made to literally not just reimagine but revise these songs to have like a whole completely new life. The first question I wanted to ask you regarding it was, what was it like for you to go, I guess, back into your history to not just properly tell the story of Imaginos with these albums, but to do them in the fashion that you did for these three records?
Well, I guess what happened was Sandy had an accident, fell down, hit his head, and was in a coma. He was in a coma for about a month. And he was being taken care of by Robert and Ronnie Duncan. And so I told Robert Duncan, if he comes out of it, let me know, because I will fly to San Francisco and I want to see him. I have stuff I have to say, just in case, you know, if he's awake, I have to say it to him. So he said, okay. So, about a month later, you know, but the very end of January, he called me and said, "Hey, Sandy came out of it." I said, "Oh, what did he say?" And he says, "He can't talk." I said, "Oh, but he seems to know what you're saying, and he reacts to what you say. So, and he can move some fingers on his left hand, I think it was, and his left toe." So I went there and I spent a couple of days with him in the hospital. I said everything I had to say, and you know, because when we were making Imaginos, and I don't mean any disrespect to Sandy, but the thing about the too many cooks, it was really, I think there was one too few by the end. It was one too few, and that was me, who wasn't there. They just, Sandy felt like I was too pushy, and he thought that he could do better without my input. So, but I was very disappointed with the record. I kind of hated it, actually. I thought that, you know, when I did go back to redo it, I was able to hear a bunch of good things that happened that I wasn't a part of. But at the time, I just thought it was terrible. And I still feel like he went off into this whole orchestral thing, you know. I mean, he's had this whole thing about, you know, that Wagner was the inventor of heavy metal. Yeah. So
some, you know, say it was Holston, Mars, bringer of war, but we digress.
Yeah. And I sing Wagner in my choral group, and it doesn't sound like heavy metal to me at all. But anyway, and I had actually sued him, and I know he was very hurt about it. And we, even though he had reconciled over the years after that, you know, especially we started losing people, you know, we lost Helen Wheels, and then we lost David Roeder, and right around the time Sandy lost his wife, Joan. And so we started talking, you know, mostly, you know, reminiscing about our friends that we lost. And so, but I hadn't really apologized for suing him, number one. And number two, telling him, you know, how important he was to me and how I felt about him, you know. Bottom line, you know, especially when you think that you might not see the guy again, which I didn't.
Right.
So, so anyway, one of the things that happened was I said, Sandy, I need you to get better because I'm going to redo Imaginos the way that you wanted, because he wanted to do certain things and I refused because I thought it wouldn't sell. So
now, was the three album concept originally your idea or his? Because
it was his.
Okay.
Oh yeah, totally. You know, so when then he died and I felt like, well, I guess I don't have to do it now. I'm out of that, you know, because he didn't get, I said, if you get better, you know, I need you to do this. And he didn't. So I thought, oh, he's letting me off the hook here. And then, so some time passed, and well, really not a whole lot of time. About a year later, I'd been working, I guess, since about 2013, 2014 with this guy, Don Falcone from San Francisco, who I've only met last May. First time we've ever met. You know, so in 10 years. So, but he has this sort of a collective where he gets people from all over the world to play on his stuff, but mostly like prog rock guys. Like, you know, he's got the guys from Cannes and Hawkwind and I don't know, Camper Van Beethoven and, you know, Dinosaur Jr. and all these, you know, these kind of different, you know, people. Arthur Brown from The Crazy World of Arthur Brown. So all he has all these people performing. So he asked me, he was going to do a trilogy with Michael Moorcock, you know,
for the Ulrich saga, I guess?
Nope. Dancers at the End of Time.
Oh, okay.
So this is the story of Jarek and his father Jagged and Amelia, oh, I can't remember her last name now. Underwood, Amelia Underwood. So those are the protagonists, and this is the at the end of time, you know, when people don't die and you don't have to, you know, you don't have to work, you know, people, you know, the biggest problem is boredom. So I started working on it, and I really got into it. The first volume, I think, had I think 14 songs, and I sang 9 of them, and wrote and sang 9, and then the others I either played drums, or I wrote some lyrics, or I made some arrangement ideas. So I got totally involved, and then the next one came along, and I was like still gung ho, you know. The first one didn't sell at all. It hardly got any attention because he was on this label called Gonzo, a British label, and they did nothing. They actually went under.
Really?
Before the second one was done. So
that's your first mistake. Never name your label after a genre of porn.
Oh, why not?
Because it goes belly up like it did.
Hey, it worked for 7 Screaming Dizbusters, one of the best songs of all time.
You should imagine my reaction when I found out what a Dizbuster was.
Oh, yeah.
Look it up, people, if you want to know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, anyway, so
I threw him off.
By the time I did finish the second one, I was like, I really should do this with Imaginos, you know. I'll get all these people to play on it, you know. And then, of course, I started doing it. I had my bass player, and I had a drummer and a female keyboard player and singer. So there was just the 4 of us. We started, and then COVID hit. So we only recorded 1 song together, you know, and I did it in my house, in my studio. So, and the drums weren't good, so I had to replace the drums myself. So I ended up doing almost all of Reimaginos by myself, except for I'd done some of the bass parts. And then when I think it was in the summer of 2020, when people could go and see each other again, it wasn't lockdown. David came over, David Hirschberg, and redid all the bass parts that I did. So, then I got RJ Ronquillo from Nashville to play guitar, who I'd seen him on YouTube. You know, he's one of these like phenomenal YouTube guitar guys, and I'm like, whoa.
Yeah, he's in all the ads for Coulter Lab products. That's how I first heard of him.
Yeah, that's what he does. That's his gig, is he does demos of products and reviews and stuff.
I use Coulter Labs because of him. Thanks, RJ.
Yeah. So he plays on all the records. I mean, you know, Richie Castellano is a big fan of his too. So, you know. He's kind of a geek, you know. I still haven't met him. I was in Nashville.
Oh, really?
And he said, "Oh yeah, come over." You know, I was this is 2022. I had this Airstream trailer that I bought, and I just finished paying it off. took the title, and it was sitting there doing nothing. I said, you know what? I don't have anything that important. You know, I'm going to take this thing and drive across the country and so see all my friends, all these people that I hadn't, you know, I mean, I saw somebody that I saw earlier that year, you know, Jay Johnson in Mushroom Shoals, but, you know, who Joe knew him from a long time ago because he was a guitar player in a group called Dead Ringer that Joe played in. But, you know, he's the son of Jay Johnson, the Swamper at Mushroom Shoals, the guitar player that played with on all those Aretha Franklin and, you know, all of that stuff. You know, play with the Stones. He played with everybody, basically. But anyway, that was his dad. So the son is a really good guitar player, too. But anyway, so we got to see him. But then I went to see Ricky Ryer, who was a BOC roadie. I hadn't seen him in about, I don't know, 10 years. And then I saw Jack Rigg, who I hadn't seen in about 7 or 8 years. And he had played on Imaginos, too. You know, on the Reimaginos, he found out I was doing it. He said, Albert, you know, I got, you know, send me a track. I'll put a guitar on it. So he did, you know, he sent me a track and I used this guitar. And then of course, Ross, the boss, you know, is like, you gotta let me do my thing. I said, okay, man. So he did, he came and he did his thing. It was great. So I had like, four guitar players, four wow. ringers come in and do a nice job. And Vaughn Burton also, who was a fan. And he had asked me to do, he asked my permission to record Girl That Loved Made Blind.
Oh.
So I said, well, you know, it's funny, I'm working on that song right now and I need a guitar. He's like, wow, what?
Nice.
He's a good kid. He's from New Jersey. So anyway, so
that's cool.
Yeah. So I had these guitar players and David Hirschberg and really, and other than, you know, my Justin Robinson ended up not being on the record at all. He actually retired from music because he got a job as programming robots.
Okay.
Yeah, computer science degree. So. And the girl keyboard player, she went back to her job and she was really shy. So I don't know that it would have worked out because she just wasn't, you know, she's a good player and everything and nice voice. But yeah, she wasn't, I could tell she was a little uncomfortable and I had to show her everything to do. And I thought, I should probably just play the keyboards and get somebody else, you know. And so the my first foray into live gigs, my brother Joe played the keyboards. And then this last run, I had my friend Susie Lorraine play the keyboard. So, you know, and, you know, but I don't know if I really even need keyboards when you play live, you know. So that's why I'm doing this tour. I don't know if you heard about that.
No.
I'm playing a tour in UK and I'm doing a couple gigs in the, you know, United States over the summer just to get warmed up to do it. But it's just me and a guitar.
Oh, okay. Oh,
cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read about that on your social media recently.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah, then,
electric guitar. Not a folk thing.
All right, cool. Because somebody gave you that idea, didn't they?
Like, we'll
somebody in the audience gave you that idea to do that?
Yes. Yes, okay. Exactly. Cool. Two nights in a row, in Leesburg, you know, at the Tally Ho. So it'd be great if you got up and just home because, you know, it's we want to see you. And then the next night at Daryl's house, this guy, I'll tell you what you should do. And I would pay all the money. Just to have you by yourself sitting on a stool telling stories, and then every once in a while you play a song. I'm like, yeah, that would be good. Yeah, maybe I'll do that. I'll take questions.
That's crazy. That's
take awesome. Requests, you know. So we're gonna see how it goes, you know.
Oh, I already know what my request would be: fireworks.
Oh my God. Okay. Well, I'm gonna have to. I better prepare for. I'll put the lyrics in the iPad. It's the first thing, and then I'll go over it a couple times, figure out how to do it, you know. Yeah.
You know, I was always amazed a lot of your songs like that.
Less. The problem with a band to teach everybody.
I think the connection got really bad.
Yeah, well, could you repeat that last part,
what
Albert?
Was that?
Your connection gets a little on and off. You're back now.
My connection. Oh, because he said, he said something about fireworks, and then I that's the thing about BOC.
Yeah,
that's what happened.
Yeah. So what did you say?
Perfect repeat of what happened. That was awesome.
Yeah. Great rehash. Anyway, what I was saying was, you know, especially yours and Joe's, you know, the more melodic ones off of like Specters and Mirrors, I was always amazed weren't picked as singles from it. I mean, Fireworks is insanely catchy, and You're Not the One I Was Looking For is brilliant. The lyrics, everything to it. And then Moon Crazy, Death Valley Nights. I mean, I love Godzilla, but Death Valley Nights, it's... screw it. I'll start from the beginning real quick.
If Donald had waited for Patty to come back, it would have been a whole different thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was Patty Smith's idea.
Really?
Godzilla.
Wow.
Oh, that's
yeah,
because she had a poem where she had Zilla God in one of the stanzas, correct?
Yeah.
I read that. Yeah, I was like, correct. Wow.
Yeah.
I never would have thought Patti Smith was that cool that she would quote Godzilla in a poem.
Oh my God. No, Patti is the coolest. She is, you know, I mean, she's a little, you know, in private, she's a lot funnier. You know, she gets kind of serious on the stage, so
I'm sure.
But in private, she's very funny and witty and cool. Very cool.
Very cool.
So
I've been listening to the Imaginos. I listened to all three of them the last few days. And the sound that you got on those albums is just amazing. Like, I hear a lot of new albums. Like, just recently, I heard the new Bruce Dickinson album. And it sounds like garbage. You know, I don't know what happened to that mix, but your album, everything is so clear. The drums are they just sound awesome. What kind of room did you record it? Did you have your own recording studio?
I recorded it. Well, the first album I recorded in my apartment. And now, of course, this last one, I did most of it in this house, which is it's basically a mansion that I'm renting,
okay,
in Queens, and I only have the bottom two floors. The top floor is another family who makes more noise than I do.
I was going to say they must love you, but
I never complain. The only complaint, I'm like, guys, if you're going to have a big party and you're going to be dancing to Latin music, please invite me. Come on. Come on. I have FOMO. So she said, okay, next time, I promise. So,
but I was just like so blown away by all, anyway, like how great the album sound, you know?
Yeah. Thanks. Well, I thing or two, you know, you know, doing a while, you know, I think that the brain surgeons, I did everything, and you know, and it never sounded the way it sounded in my head. Right. Whereas these Imaginos records, well, except for the first one. After the first one, I decided not to. I was losing my hearing, actually, and I could
really,
I realized it. I couldn't hear high end. Yeah. So I mean, I still have it. I have your hearing aids now. So
wow,
because I you know, it's still hard for me to hear. So if I put it on, you know how the hearing aids now.
It's him with the bad connection, right? Not us.
Connecting.
Yeah, I don't know. You got terrible internet. There we go.
Darn you, Time Warner Cable of Queens.
Yeah, so I have two.
Spectrum, whatever you're called now.
Yeah, so I got. Yeah, Spectrum. That's right. Time Warner. Ooh. My God. I stopped watching TV because of them. It was probably a good thing.
I'd say so.
Oh, is he frozen again, or is he pretending he's frozen?
I hope he's pretending, but I doubt it.
Darn.
He'll come back.
Oh, you guys are frozen.
No, it's you. It's your fault. Keep doing well, that. It doesn't seem to go out, so keep doing that.
Yes.
That might be.
Hey, look, you know, we're doing it live.
I know,
okay?
It's me because all three of you go like. Yeah. Still, I'm like, oh no. Oh no, it happened again. That means I'm still.
Yeah.
Next time that happens, I can take off all my.
It just happened.
you know what though? I don't mind so much. It's such an honor to talk to you. You know, Lou was talking about how he got into DOC with the cassette tape. For me, I was about 8. Parents got me a turntable. My dad's like, oh yeah, you can have the rest of my albums. And it was this record right here, looking at the cover. And then putting it on with Satan's Hog, No Pig at All, and the weather's getting dry. I was like, what is this? And then just as it went on.
Yeah.
You know, that cobwebby production sound, just how. Yeah, I want to say insightful, but maybe it's just how odd and Cthulhu mythos a lot of Sandy's lyrics were, but. Just mesmerizing stuff, man. And that's why I was so excited about the Reimaginos project, because reading about that, what you and Sandy had said in interviews over the years, and a little bit of Don too, although it didn't seem like either him or Eric were real into that whole project, but reading about it and then knowing some of the mythology from loving the first three records so much, and then actually getting that album, because it was out of print at the time, mid-late 90s, it was really hard to find. And then listening to that, it's like, what in the hell happened here? So it was really,
yeah,
really
well,
awesome.
It was, yeah, well, listen to this. The joke was on me, though. Because it didn't come out. Well, it did come out, but it, you know, not as my album. You know, they had to bail me out, basically.
I guess an interesting question I'd like answered is, you know, I mean, it's safe to say that the band and the concept, you know, was kind of there from the beginning, with traces of the concept spread throughout every album. How come there was never an innate idea to kind of have the first three albums based solely on the concepts of Imaginos? Like, why was it, I guess, more important to just, I guess, spread the seeds of the story through every album? Was it sort of like, Did you as musicians and as artists think, let the fans kind of put it together for themselves? Was it sort of like that?
No. Sandy had the story, but he didn't have the songs. And he was very, he would work on these things for years. You know, I don't know if you heard that I got a suitcase. When his cousin Michelle, who was his only heir, she inherited his house on Long Island. And so she had just sold it last year. And she called up by the Stony Brook professor, Norm Pressland, and said, there's all these papers here. You want to come and get them? I mean, somebody might be, you know, want to see them. And of course, there's about 1,000 pages of mostly lyrics, you know, like, you know, 13 versions of Are You Ready to Rock? You know, or I think it was probably like 20 versions of Astronomy. So he spent a lot of time getting lyrics just the way he wanted them. And I think that, so he didn't provide us with the whole an album's worth of Imaginos songs. He would just dole them out a little by little. So,
gotcha. And they usually were
so many words also that, you know, it was hard for us to figure out how to put all these words into a song where it wasn't like a one of these drony songs. This goes forever. So we really had to get into the words. So I think that, you know, like that's why Subhuman, you know, we did the Subhuman. It was only like a quarter of the lyrics or a third of the lyrics. Eric left all this other stuff out, you know. He's like, oh, it would have, yeah. Because he was doing it real slow, you know. And so when I redid it for Imagine Those, I put every word. And it's a lot of words.
I really like how you did part of it instrumentally as Overture with Brain Surgeons, too. That was a really cool Easter egg on Box of Hammers.
Yeah. You know, I was just thinking about that because it's if you were to get the vinyl, it's on the vinyl. It's at the end of the vinyl, the last song after Les Invisibles is the Overture. And so when I did the second Bombs Over Germany, I wanted to have a second Overture at the beginning. And I started working on When the War Comes, which I changed to When War Comes, because I changed everything. Because when I first heard that, what was that on?
Club Ninja.
Right. So on Club Ninja, I heard it and I was like, I was mad because he had taken half of the lyrics from Half-Life Time and used it in this other song. And I'm like, but albums over Germany. So, you know, so I took all the words from Half-Life Time out of it. And then I filled it in with instrumental stuff that was, you know, kind of sounded like an overture. Just a kind of overture. You know, it was months, you know, just germinating in my head. You know, I have my notes and I'm writing down, like, how can I do this? And, well, maybe if I put a little bit of Beck's Bolero in there. So,
The connection's killing.
Yeah, so that's how that came about. That's yeah. Cool. Oh, you can't hear what I'm saying, huh?
And it keeps breaking in.
Here, let me.
Anyways, let's continue to plug his website, Albert Bouchard at bandcamp.com. Buy his stuff. Okay? Remember. When you buy from an artist's Bandcamp, it goes directly to the artist. However, Albert didn't realize he had a Bandcamp, so I hope he's getting a cut of that.
Yeah. It's going to go to my record company. It's going to go to them. But you know, the thing is that, I mean, they must have done this. The thing is that they pay. I have made money, you know, with the Brain Surgeons, not to bring up a sore subject, but... You know, I lost money on every record. I never made money. It was like a money losing thing. And we'd tour and we would lose money. So this time, starting with this Imagino stuff, I make money on every record. That's a crazy thing. You know, I retired from teaching for 30 years. So
repeat what you said again, because it keeps cutting out. You know?
I don't have to do anything. Oh.
Well, I'm sorry. Unfortunately, that cut off. So you said with the Brain Surgeons, it was losing money. And with Reimagine, as you said, the label is actually taking care of you.
Yes.
Okay. Well, that's a good thing. That's a very good thing.
Yes. Great. Yeah, we'll take a very small percentage. Yeah, it's like an amazing deal that I got with them.
So, very cool.
Yeah, very good, very good. The band Blue Coop, how did that all become to be? Because you got Dennis Dunaway and then your brother as well, and it's very good out. You know, how many albums you put out now? I think what, four?
I think on the fourth. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Four. Yeah, we put out four records. So, and but this last one is kind of there's not really anything new on it. Everything that is on it is either a remix of an old song or the songs that did make it. You know, we always record more songs than we put on the records. So these were the ones that we didn't, for one reason or another. Like, I mean, what's the thing? The Mothra song. That was, we could have put it on, but they didn't want to pay the Toho the thing. And then, you know, then what, they're looking for stuff. I said, well, how about this thing, the Tish and Snooki thing? It's amazing. And they said, oh, but you know, it's going to be so much. So I looked it up. It was like $500. Come on.
Wow.
Just give them the $500 and put it on the record, and then, which is what we did. So wow. It was nothing.
You're on mute, Lou.
Thank you. I said, to provide context, Soho is the company that owns Godzilla and Mothra and the likenesses.
Yeah.
Right. Exactly. So, but it was really not a lot. It was very reasonable. So,
sounds like a pricier mechanical license, if anything.
Yeah. Yeah. It was slightly more, but not bad at all. And, you know, then there was the Robbie Krieger, you know. He and when we did first, the first version that we did sounded just like the Doors. And okay, oh, no, we can't do that.
Oh, Robbie Krieger.
But then, yeah, yeah. So, but then Robbie played on it. So we ended up doing it just like we were doing it, you know. But Joe was singing it, you know. He does it better, Morrison, than me. So I just sang like myself. So I wasn't trying to sound like Morrison. Anyway, so let's see what else. Well, Trick of Moonlight. Now that one was. I love that song. I wrote that with David Roeder. And you guys.
Bro, you keep freezing.
We hear you though.
Oh.
You know what? Try turn your camera off. Sometimes this helps. Sometimes.
What? Turning the camera off and turning camera it back off. On?
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe. Is that better?
No.
There we go. Can you hear
right
me?
Now talk. Yeah.
We hear you fine, yeah. No?
I think now.
Oh, yeah.
All right, there you go.
Okay.
There we go. That works.
Maybe that'll work.
Yeah. And we can hear you.
Should I turn it back on? I think having the extra data is messing up my connection.
Yeah, I think so. But now it sounds okay. I don't even know. What did we leave off with?
Yeah.
So we're talking about Robbie Krieger and how it was sounding too much like the Doors.
I guess that didn't sound the problem.
My son of a gun.
Dennis wrote Hollow's Grave. Is it still a problem?
Yeah.
No? Can you hear me?
Yeah, we hear you.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So... So, you know, Hollow's Grave, you know, he wrote it for Alice Cooper, and then Alice Cooper ended up singing on it.
Yeah. So,
but yeah, so yeah, we haven't done a whole lot with Blue Coop. Dennis has got these other gigs, you know, he's, you know, working a lot with Alice now. So,
yeah.
So, which is good. I'm happy about that. And I'm wall to wall stuff going on too with the Dictators and Shaking Street, doing a new Shaking Street record. So
now,
that's coming out really good.
Good. But before I forget again, I wanted to mention what I was talking about before we started. Gunn, that they're putting on the new BOC record, and
yeah,
you had also done with Brain Surgeon. Now, first time I heard it was that live bootleg from the Soft White Underbelly show, I think, on the Mirrors tour.
Okay, yeah,
maybe Colossaurus. I can't remember.
Yeah, that was an old song that Joe wrote with Helen. So, a true story too. So
really,
oh wow,
yeah,
it's amazing. We can call the moon, but we can't have
also.
It's ridiculous.
Yeah. Also, she wrote a song that the Brain Surgeons did called "Jimmy Booth Fetish," which was about the same guy, Jim.
Oh,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah, he was a wild man.
Hey, yeah, well, it was a good song.
yeah, two good songs.
Yeah, two great songs. Yeah,
yeah. Too bad he had to go to jail.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, what were you gonna say, Greg?
I'm excited to hear it's, you know, I suppose finished off. When this comes out, but I have to say I always love the Brain Surgeons version of it. I can't lie, I prefer your vocals, but Deborah did do a really good job on there. Not to bring up a sore spot again, but
yeah. No, she you know, she had her sound. I think that, you know, ultimately it didn't work as well for me because she didn't blend well with my voice. When we harmonized, it never worked, you know, whereas when Susie Lorraine was singing with me on the Imagino stuff, it's like, it's magic. It's like, it rings. It has this like quality that great harmony has, you know. She's just a phenomenal harmony singer. So,
There is some live footage of you both performing together, and the band sounds great, and the vocals sound as good as they ever have. So, yeah, it definitely sounds like you have a solid lineup.
She is because back to her old job. I couldn't hear what you just said. Star lineup?
No, I was just saying that it sounds like you have a solid lineup, and the vocals sound as good as they ever have in the past, you know, like with believe it or not, like when I think of BOC, I think of the vocal harmonies, you know, you singing with Joe and with Buck and with like on a song such as ME262. They sounded great then, and what you're doing with Susan now sounds just as good.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, with BOC, we rarely worked on our harmonies, and that was one of the reasons why we got signed, was because, you know, and Eric, you know, even though, you know, he's like the lead singer supposedly, but he was a great harmony singer. When he sings a high harmony, it's almost like Graham Nash. It has this like ringing quality to it, you know, because he's very in tune also. That's the other thing about Eric. He sang more in tune than anybody. So still does, even though he can't hit the high notes anymore. But actually he can, but I don't know. He just doesn't want to.
Interesting. I didn't think he could anymore. That's really interesting to know.
Yeah, I heard him, but he, you know, what happens? If you do you're doing a show, you know, every night, you know, you're going out on these long tours and, you know, you kind of don't want to give it all like that, you know, not be able to sing the next day or whatever. So I understand. I don't have that problem because I haven't had that many long tours as a lead singer.
At the height
you do like two or three shows and that's it.
At the height of BOC's popularity, about how many concerts average a year would you say that you guys did?
Well, we did a lot more of them. We weren't popular. You know, we and you know, for the 4 years before Agents of Fortune, we each year we played about 250 shows. So by the time we got to Agents, we'd logged about 1,000 big concerts. And then we cut back to about 150, something like that. You know, almost a little bit more than half of the, you know, we built in time for vacations and babies and all of that kind of stuff. So it was much more human kind of schedule. I don't think we could have kept it up. I mean, I think that, you know, even now, I think Blue Oyster Cult's log, you know, some sort of record number of shows in the lifetime of the group. So, So I know, but I've heard him sing, you know, but he'll beg off and say, oh no, I can't do it now. I gotta mm-hmm. save my voice. No, I get it. You know, he sings really high. I mean, for the songs that I sang on Reimaginos and the whole trilogy, a lot of the songs, I just lowered the key, just lowered it till it was, I could sing it full voice and feel right, comfortable. So,
no, yeah. That definitely worked to your benefit. I mean, like I said, the songs just take on a new life of their own. You know, I enjoyed the recently updated versions of those classic songs as much as I do the classic. Yeah. And I mean, that's the thing that I've always appreciated about the original lineup as musicians is the fact that. And this is not to knock the genre of metal, but to me, BOC was not just like a metal band. I mean, you guys did rock, you did new wave, you did jazz, you did blues, you did country. You were your own sound. And I think that's where like all these tastemakers, I don't know where they get the idea to just lump BOC into one genre. It's one sound, and that's just the five of you. You know, how important was it for everybody to, I guess, just keep up their musical chops or not just stay focused or fixated on one genre?
I think that just, you know, I mean, we all played different things, you know, and you know, it was, I think the first three albums that, and that's one of the things that a lot of people like about them is that they didn't go too far out of our wheelhouse. You know, I remember when Don brought Reaper in, and it was really, I don't want to take, you know, unnecessary credit, but you know, he said, I wrote this song, but I don't think it's right for the group. I just don't think we should do it. And I listened to it. I said, are you crazy? This song is a stone cold hit. We've got to do it. He's like, I don't know. You think it's a hit? I don't. It's okay. It's kind of repetitious. I said, no. And it will. Hey, Nameless doesn't want me to talk about it, but he said, no way am I doing this song. You know, if you want to do it, then I'm out. I said, oh, well, don't be a stranger. We're Sandy, are you doing this song? Murray, I've been waiting for you guys to come up with something like this. Come on. This is it. This is going to be a hit. I swear to God, if I ever heard a hit, this is a hit. And of course, you know, and so then all of a sudden it was like, we could do anything after that, because it was so unlike anything that we did, except that it did have that, you know, a little bit of the horror genre in there, because it had the Reaper, you know.
Right.
I mean, you know, if he said, don't fear death, or don't fear, you know, the end or whatever, it would have been, you know, it would have been more pop, but he said, don't fear the Reaper.
God, and how many movies has that song been in? You know,
it's like, oh my God.
Halloween Ends, Scream, The Stand.
Gone Girl, Orange is the New Black. It goes on. The list goes on every year. It's, yeah.
I think it needs to be said. I think it really needs to be said. The cowbell is not that prevalent in the song. That was a fucking waste.
Yes. What do you think about that Saturday Night Live skit? It was funny when it first was on, but now
the first time.
Yeah, and now it's just like, I'm tired of people saying it. But how do you feel about that whole skit?
Well, you know, I think that how they build it up, and you know how big thing, it's a little bit ridiculous. But I have, even now when I watch the skit, I still find things that I didn't see, and I'm like, oh my God, really? This is just, it's so funny.
Yeah. It well, really you lived is, it too.
You so. Know, the, I, yeah, well, you know, the other thing is that it was not unlike what actually happened, you know? I mean, really? You know, you know how it is in the studio, you try something and nobody knows if it's good, and then you're like, well, what if we did this? What if you do that? You know, so well, there was a bunch of that. You know, I won't remember. He said, I wanted to play the triangle. That was the thing. I wanted to play the triangle in the middle, and the bong, down, down, ding, ding,
right,
down, 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 ding, ding. That's who I wanted it, and he said, okay, you can do that, but you got to play a cowbell in the verses. I'm like, what? Why? And so he talked me into doing it, and this is David Lucas, the other producer.
Yeah, not Bruce Dickinson. I mean, it just baffled me, because it's like they got everyone wrong. First of all, they called Chris Parnell, who looked like Buck Dharma, they called him Eric. And then the guy that looked like Eric Bloom, his name was Gene. And Alan Lanier did not have a mustache back then. He didn't grow a mustache until 1980. No,
that was me.
That was Albert.
That was me. That was the lead guitar player. That was supposed to be me. And the guy that looked like Alan was playing the drums.
Did he just switch a room?
Yeah. Jimmy Fallon was, you know, dressed up as Alan. It was ridiculous, but you know, and Bruce Dickinson was the legacy producer. So what he did is he repackaged the album and put it out, stuck his name on there. But I knew him before, when he was so A&R at Chrysalis, because I was trying to get a deal for this group I was producing. So yeah, so he's been around though, you know, but. It is odd that he has the same name as the guy from Iron Maiden.
Yeah, well,
it's part of the appeal of this.
Yeah, but that Bruce Dickinson, I've seen him on two albums, Blue Oyster Cult and the Outfields Legacy recording. That's about it. I haven't seen it anywhere else.
Yeah. I don't think he were. I'm going to do.
Sorry, Albert, what was that?
They're doing a 50th anniversary for SNL.
Oh, really?
And one entire episode is going to be the cowbell. So my segment is going to have Bruce Dickinson, Murray Krugman, and myself. talking about it. So,
oh, cool.
Very cool.
But they had Jimmy Fallon talking about what he did, and you know, and of course Will Ferrell and what's his name?
Chris Kattan, Chris Parnell,
Christopher Walken, yeah.
All right, him. Christopher Walken.
Speaking of the agent sessions and the legacy recording, though, I will say I love Sally, man. That was the highlight to me of that remaster.
Yeah. Yeah. I love that version that I did for that song, the Smith song. And I didn't know why they didn't put it on the record. I don't know. I guess it was just too much. It was abundance of good stuff. But it did come out.
One thing I'd also like to promote is your YouTube channel. You now have sort of become a not a social media influencer, but you've become more of a presence on YouTube. For example, I think you're in your eighth season of your video diary series, Most Cowbell.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a lot of fun. I enjoy that a lot. So it feels like I'm talking to the fans, and you know, it's I don't know, evolved into sort of a advice column. You know, I had these thoughts, about like living life and stuff, and the challenges that you face, and how to deal with them. So yeah, and I do like to play a little, play a little guitar. I keep saying I'm going to do a whole episode on KG Creighton, the drum part. Well, actually, the whole song. Yeah, wouldn't that be fun?
Oh yeah, and you totally have to call it "Repeating Taste of High Heel Shoe." I love that line.
Good idea.
Yeah, actually,
"Repeating Taste of High Heel Shoe."
If I had to pick my favorite lyrics from a song you did, though, and I know you and Joe wrote it together, I'm not sure which one, but "Wings Wetted Down," man, that is just beautiful.
Yeah, that's a great song. I didn't really have that much to do with it. I didn't have anything to do with the lyrics. Joe wrote the lyrics all by himself, and all I was responsible was for, I think, the bridge and the end of the chorus. Where it goes, "In the end, the end, the end."
That's awesome.
You know, so that's all I did, but I got to put my name on there.
Yeah, but
go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just gonna ask, not just your drumming and your singing and your songwriting, but your arrangements, and I would say your quality control of the band's output for that 10-year period. There's very few bands where I could say that their quality control was as good as BOC's. And I think that a big part of the responsibility would fall on you. So I guess when it came to the quality control aspect of the band, what was it that kind of made you take that role, or, how important was that role for you?
I didn't consciously think about it, but eventually the other guys would say, "How come every time we have a practice, you come in the next day with ideas to change everything?" And I'd say, "Well, because this way you can do it the way you're doing it, but I think it's something is wrong with it, and the records that after me, and I'm not even trying to be cynical about it. To my concept of how to make something sound big or power or whatever you're do sound small, just because you want the next thing to come in huge, you know, so you have to have the contrast. And there was a lot of things that they didn't really understand about arranging. And I was the one that kind of pushed that. I definitely did, you know, even on the songs that I did not write, you know, like the whole arrangement for Eric's song, for almost all of Eric's songs, except for Emmy 262, but for Veterans, you know, that was my arrangement, basically. I wrote the whole thing. I mean, John Trivers wrote the bass line, and Eric sang, you know, Michael Moorcock's lyrics. But, you know, all of that drum thing and the middle part and the little break and all of that stuff. So,
very cool.
Or Black Blade. Didn't write the song, Eric. What should we do? Eric was really great about, you know, understanding my worth. And really, even when they let me go, he said, "I'm going on record, and as this is a bad idea." I'll never forget that. He said, "But you know what? I got to go with the majority."
Well, it's really good to see that everyone's in each other's good graces, and yeah, you know, collaborating again, and you're still coming out with great quality output. And honestly, like, speaking for the three of us as huge fans of yours as a member of the band and as a musician and as a person in general, we're so happy that you're still around. And, you know, we're beyond grateful that you gave three lucky schmucks like us a chance to have a conversation with you. Albeit with spectrum difficulties, but we are, you know, honored to have you on the show tonight. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. It's a privilege, really. I appreciate you guys.
Thanks, Albert. This is my favorite one we've ever done. I mean, personal hero, man. I'm so honored you came on tonight.
Oh, well, I'm happy to do it. Yeah. There's no downside for me. Okay.
Is there throughout your whole career of Blue Oyster Cult and everything you're doing now, is there one thing that's like the biggest thing that you've done, or something that was the most favorite thing that you've done over the years?
Well, I think things are getting better. I mean, I wrote a song for the Dictators that I'm like, holy crap, this might be the best. I mean, it wasn't my song. It was Keith Roth. He wrote it, but he'd sent all these, you know, when we were trying to find songs for this record, because Andy usually is the songwriter, but he's very slow. I don't know if he's probably slowed down over the years, and he's getting very picky about his songs. So I like to write fast and then rewrite. But anyway, so Keith had sent out a whole bunch of songs to the guys, and Andy picked one, and he said, "We're going to do this one," and Andy helped him arrange it and write it. I actually ended up having to step in because it wasn't popping, so I made it pop. One day I think I smoked some pot, and I was like, "Oh, this is what I should do." Total Keith Moon. and I played this crazy drum part, and they're like, "Oh, that's kind of, can you dial it back a little bit?" So I did. I dialed it back, and then for some reason they came over, and I put up, because I saved everything. I was a file. So I said, "I can go back over the different iterations." So I had the wrong one up, and they heard the drum thing, and they're like, "Whoa, that's great!" You know. Of course, it was here in my studio with the good monitors and everything. "We got it. You got to do it like that." I said, "I did it like that. It's right there. We just..." But I did this song with Keith that nobody was interested in, and I heard something in the song. I said, "This." this is one little bit that's it's a stone cold hook, man. It's it here. And so I turned the arrangement totally inside out, took that little bit, a chorus or anything. I made it the chorus. I made it the title, you know. It is, because it'll be out in the end of May or the middle of May. So it's not finished. But yeah, so and you'll see it's I'm like, man, this is really catchy. And so then I just made an arrangement where I thought, this is what the Dictators need. And we just played a tour with the Damned. And I have to say, I respect those guys so much. They just keep going and they get better. Each record is like a little bit better than the one before, you know, even though they're older, they just are honing in on their thing. And I loved how they did the wordless vocals. And when we're in Spain with the Dictator, a savage beat, a savage beat, every time you get to the whole audience was singing along. And I said, oh, Dictators, they're fans, they love to sing along. We need more sing along on this record, you know, that's what's missing. So I made a song part like that, a wordless vocal. And dang, it's really good. It's really a great thing. So I'm very happy about that. I really can't wait to hear it. And
very cool. Very cool. Well, yeah. Like Luke said, we all appreciate that you're still, you know, continuing to do music and everything. And I just wish you had a better internet connection. God damn.
Look, you're always welcome back again at a later date. Yes. Albert, anytime you want to promote anything,
I'll take it into the studio. I'll take this computer into the studio. It's much better. I have what do you call it, Cat 5 there. So so this is just wireless, that's the problem. And this, like I say, I'm in a mansion, so it's about 150 feet to the studio. So
all right, so next time you go into the studio,
yeah, get just
yeah, definitely. We'd love to have you back anytime you have a tour or a new album that you want to promote or a new project. Consider this an open invitation.
Great. Well, it's been fun being on Rat Salad.
Oh wow, you remember the name? Thank you.
Yeah. One of the few guests that do.
Review. What's the significance of that?
It's a Black Sabbath song.
Drum solo, Bill Ward.
Yeah, Wayne went through a couple of names at first, and then that was the one that stuck, I guess.
Yeah. I didn't make it up, but somebody else did, but yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, and Lou and I actually do kind of a side one about, or called Screams from the Grave, about more obscure, forgotten albums, and Mirrors was actually one I wanted to do, if you were ever interested in talking about that.
Yeah.
Too.
That would be great. Yeah, we'll have him come back on for an episode of Screams. Absolutely. Albert, we'll definitely work that around your schedule.
Okay. Sounds great.
Sounds good. And good. If anybody wants to go see your social medias or your websites or anything, where can they go if you even know where they are? Do you know?
Well, I'm on Facebook. I have a friend page and a fan page, but the friend page has got about, I think you can only have like 5,000, so
I
got like 4,090. So somebody will have to drop out. Maybe I'll post some more rants about Trump and see what happens. I can make some space.
Oh yeah, and before we go, your support for Safe Stages and all that when all that was happening, that was really cool. That was an awesome accomplishment there.
Yeah. Well, I got a thing I'm doing for, it's a benefit for the Long Island Music and Entertainment Hall of Fame. June 7th at CW Post College at the Tyler Center. and it's going to have the Young Rascals, Zebra, mm-hmm. Billy Joel, his daughter, I can't remember, Sarah Joel, I think it is, or something. And,
Alexa Ray Joel, yeah.
Debbie Gibson.
Jeez.
And Joe and I are going to be playing with Jules Rodino and Danny Miranda.
Oh, cool.
Doing some, yeah. He does Billy Joel.
If you need a third guitar player, let me know. I'd love to jam on that. That'd be great.
Yeah. Yeah, that's going to be fun. So
very cool. And so yes, he's on YouTube. He's on Instagram. He's on Facebook. Just look up Albert Bouchard. Yep. And remember, yep. Buy his stuff over at albertbouchard.bandcamp.com.
Oh, and also in YouTube is tons of videos. Music videos of all the things, you know, from Blue Coop to, you know, Dictators to my solo stuff.
Very cool. I just hit subscribe to your YouTube channel, and I sent you a friend request again, so hit the accept button.
will do.
All right.
Will do.
Albert, thank you so much for coming on tonight.
Yeah, thank you so much. And like I said, next time we got a better internet connection and we will talk more. All right. Thank you.
Okay.
You're awesome. Now that
we see you before we leave.
Okay.
Right. Have a good night. See everybody. You. Thank you for watching RatsoundReview.com and we'll be back next week.
SeverAngel.com. Absalon, new album. Get them.
Get them while they're hot. Bye, everybody.
Great.
Hati tati. Good night.
Oh, we're actually already friends on Facebook. Cool.